Does this sound like your day? Get up in the morning, get a cup of coffee, sit in front of your computer to check email. Get ready for work, sit in the car, on the way to sit at your desk all day. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A lot of us spend a lot of time sitting. Dr. Stephen Blair is an exercise scientist at the University of South Carolina, and he believes that all of that sitting is very, very dangerous. This hour, Dr. Blair will take a stand on sitting down, and we'll talk about the risks we face as a society because of our sedentary lifestyles. We'll also find out why we need to be less focused on our so-called obesity epidemic. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Are you sitting down right now? Chances are good that the answer is yes. A lot of us spend a lot of our time sitting at computers, sitting in meetings, sitting in our cars. And according to Dr. Stephen Blair, all that sitting is dangerous. Dr. Blair is an exercise scientist from the University of South Carolina and a Wellness Council of America expert on taking a stand on sitting down. He visited Iowa City last week to lecture on behalf of the Obesity Research and Education Initiative, and I took the opportunity to, yes, sit down with him. Dr. Blair, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Charity.
Now, we've been talking about our nation's obesity epidemic now for a long time, and we've been hearing about different possible reasons for that epidemic over the years. And a lot of those reasons have been too many sugary drinks, too much fatty food. You think that we are looking in the wrong direction. Why is that?
Well, first of all, there is no compelling evidence that Americans are eating any more now than they did 30 or 40 years ago, especially if you take into account that we are bigger. We've gained 20 or 25 pounds, and bigger animals actually need more energy just to stay alive. Elephants need more calories than mice, you see. So when we look at the caloric intake of Americans, especially if we adjust for increases in body size, we are not eating anymore. I mean, there's just no compelling evidence that we're eating more. So the cause has to lie on the other side of the energy balance equation. We must be burning less. And we have published some pretty good data, I think, on that topic. Now, should we eat a healthy diet? Of course. Focus on fruit and vegetables, whole grains rather than highly processed grains, not too much fat, not too much alcohol. Of course, those are good suggestions. But to continue to blame, as the pundits do, both in the media and in science, oh, this obesity epidemic, it's due to fast foods and sugar and sugar and sugar and the worst thing that ever happened. Well, there's just no really good evidence to support that.
Okay, so where is it coming from?
Well, it's coming from sitting too much, you might be surprised to hear, as you said a moment ago. Now, do you believe, could we find anyone who believed that there has been no change in occupational energy expenditure over the last 50 years in the United States? Would anyone say, oh, no, it's absolutely the same on average across the country? People spend just as many calories on the job as they did 50 years ago. Well, first of all, the pattern of jobs has changed a lot. A lot fewer people in agriculture. And boy, back when I was the first person in my family to go to college, I said, let me get off of this farm. I said, there's got to be a better way to make a living. So people leaving agriculture, mining, manufacturing jobs going down. What has gone up? Service jobs, sitting on your hind end jobs. And that's doubled in the last 50 years.
Well, and so, we do it in our leisure time, too. We sit at computers all the time.
Yes, the screen time and leisure time, that's another issue. We published a paper 2 or 3 years ago showing that the decline in occupational energy expenditure over the last 50 years has been 140 calories a day in men and 120 calories a day in women. You say, well, that doesn't sound like very much. No, but that's day after day after day after day. And the obesity experts say that the obesity epidemic can be explained by a positive caloric balance of 70, 80, 90 calories a day. So the decline in occupational is more than enough to explain it.
Wow.
And in fact, when we modeled those data and used them to predict the weights of Americans over the last 50 years, it was just spot on.
So we're sitting at our computers. We are not moving around during the day, but we talk about fitness all the time. And there are a lot of people who work hard to make sure that they do exercise every day. That's not enough?
Well, if it is for those people who do it. But again, the self-reported leisure time activity, walking, jogging, running, swimming, tennis, those numbers, the percent of adult Americans who do those things has stayed pretty flat over the last 30 or 40 years. So that 25-30% of the population, yeah, they're getting sufficient activity. And those are the people who are not gaining as much weight, gaining perhaps not gaining any weight over time. So yeah, there are people who do that. It's the rest of us who are not working on the job, not spending calories on the job. And another big area is, well, what about around the house? Household energy management. So we published a paper a few weeks ago on that topic, and American women, on average, over the last 50 years, they've had a decline in household energy expenditure of 1,800 calories a week.
Wow.
Absolutely huge. And in addition, in the same paper, we reported a 12-hour increase in screen time. So sitting more, we're not criticizing women. We got a lot of attacks in the blogosphere that, oh, you're saying women are fat, lazy slobs, and if they just do more, they would. No, we weren't saying this is just part of the explanation.
Well, and it's not just because our houses aren't as clean or because we're sharing more of that. There are other changes as well, right?
Oh, of course. You're a young person, and you don't remember when there was no such thing as a self-propelled vacuum cleaner. Or I can even remember when really there were no vacuum cleaners. Grandma didn't have one. My mom didn't have one. In fact, in our home, when I was a little kid, there was no electricity. So if you want to eat, you have to have a wood stove. Somebody has to chop the wood, carry it in the house, put it in the stove, tend it, cook, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that lifestyle, well, maybe it exists out in somebody's cabin in the mountains, but, it's huge changes in the way we live at home as well as on the job.
Well, and you've even written about some of the smaller changes, like the fact that we don't have to crank the window in the car to open it and close it. Even little things like that, you think are making a big difference?
Well, it's a tiny number of calories we're using the electric window. But you add them all up over time, things are just easier. Now, the hotel I'm staying in here in Iowa City, I noticed that at all the exits, there's push the button to open the door. Now, there are people who are disabled who need that. But I think it's almost a sin to add to the carbon footprint by pushing that button and have electricity open the door for you. Oh, my goodness. Just push it, walk through.
Well, and of course, our remote controls are keeping our bottoms firmly planted on the couch as well.
Oh, there have just been hundreds, thousands of changes that have made life easier. That is, in the sense of spending fewer calories to get through the day. Now, are we going to go back to the Stone Age and become hunters and gatherers?
No.
Well, I don't know. Maybe after we use up all the oil and everything, maybe it'll revert to that. But we're not going to do that willingly. So what are we going? Are we going to ban automobiles? Are we going to ban electric windows and electric doors? I don't think so. So we have to look to other opportunities and other ways to get people moving more.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of those ways, because not everybody is going to become a runner.
No.
Not everybody is going to make, 45 minutes for a nice vigorous walk every day. What are some of the little things that we can do in our workplaces that you feel would make a big difference?
Well, it is complex, and it will take there's no one single answer, of course. And sure, not everyone's going to run 45 minutes every day. Let me just go ahead and mention that our first official U.S. physical activity guidelines were published, I think, about six years ago. And that recommendation is 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity a week in bouts of 10 minutes or more. So 3 10-minute walks a day, 5 days a week, you got 150 minutes.
Right, or a 30-minute walk.
A 30-minute walk each day. Or if you like vigorous sports or running, then you can get the same dose in 75 minutes a week. so it doesn't take as much time. You tell me you're pressed. Okay, then run instead of walk. But, I mean, how hard is it really for somebody to fit in, say, 3 10-minute walks over the course of a day? And, in fact, there's a growing body of evidence that getting up from that computer and taking that walk, when you come back, you can focus better, you don't make as many mistakes, you can think better. So I think those are possibilities. Look for opportunities to get up and move. And there are companies that are implementing programs that require, or at least strongly encourage, your computer will flash, say, okay, it's time for you, Charity, to take that 5-minute walk. Because although I said 10-minute blocks, there's other research showing that even just taking that short walk, getting up, moving around, and you're better when you get back at your computer. Well, so there are lots and lots of things like that.
I have heard a lot of people say over the years in talking about a difficulty in implementing an exercise routine, saying, boy, if there were just some sort of immediate gratification to exercising, if I looked better after I exercised. But you're really saying that there is some immediate gratification to getting up and moving around.
Well, I think, and it comes to the brain probably. And so this is pretty recent research, and of course we need more on this. But exercise affects the brain as well as the heart. And there's evidence showing that's true for little kids, and it's true for old geezers like me, that your brain seems to function better if you're getting some exercise. Now, do you need the 150 minutes a week and 10-minute bouts? We don't know for sure in all those cases, but there is evidence that just standing up and doing a little stretching and moving around at your desk is probably good for you. Helps you focus more when you sit back down and go to work.
Even if it's 30 or 60 seconds?
Probably. Maybe I should say 60 seconds, because that is an area where we do have some pretty good research from some colleagues down in Australia. Genevieve Healy has looked at what she calls breaks in sitting time. And a break she defines as 1 minute or more. And again, not running, but just not sitting, getting up and moving around a little bit. And people who sit the same amount of time, same number of hours per day, those who take more breaks in that time have lower triglycerides, smaller waist circumference, lower weight. So it doesn't take a lot to get some of these benefits.
So they're showing the same kind of benefits that people who really do implement a regular exercise routine.
Well, on some of those variables that I mentioned, we don't have data at this point on breaks and sitting times and heart attacks or lung cancer. Whether we ever will or not, I don't know. But the point is, just a little bit of activity now and then does seem to have some benefits.
I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Blair. He is an exercise scientist from the University of South Carolina, and he's a Wellness Council of America expert on taking a stand on sitting down. We're talking about our sedentary lifestyles this hour and some of the things that we can do to change our sedentary behavior. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about our sedentary lifestyles, some of the dangers of doing too much sitting, some of the things we can do to counteract the sedentary lifestyles that come along with most of our jobs and other changes in our lives. With me right now is Dr. Stephen Blair. He is an exercise scientist from the University of South Carolina, and he visited Iowa City last week to lecture on behalf of the Obesity Research and Education Initiative at the University of Iowa. Now, before the break, we were talking about how you have seen evidence that some very small changes, just standing up, moving around for a minute, can have real positive impacts on our health. There are new movements in workplace environments to try to come up with ways to help people get more physical activity, even though they have to spend all day staring at a computer screen. What are some of the changes in workplaces that you see having real benefits?
Well, one of the things that's been happening is the emergence of standing desks. And there are several companies now that make these, and more people have them. I have one in my office back at the university. So you spend more of your day standing than sitting. And now, again, this is a pretty new area of research. But it looks as if just standing is better than sitting. So let's try to get people to stand more with a standing desk. Another thing, at universities and lots probably here at public radio, you have meetings, right? You go in a room and you sit down and talk.
Lots and lots of meetings,
so,
yes.
So what about a walking meeting? This is a beautiful city. Now, I don't know, maybe in the middle of January you might not want to go out for that walk, but more and more places are implementing walking meetings. Why not? I mean, why wouldn't that work just as well? Well, maybe even better. If you're walking, your brain works better. Maybe the meeting would be more functional. And then, of course, let's build the parking lots a mile away from each building. How about that? So you have to park.
People would complain a lot about that.
They might complain about that. What about putting the trash bin a little further? Well, then they'd just throw it in the corner, wouldn't they? So we need creative people to be thinking about how can those of us in sedentary jobs, how can we get more activity built into our day?
Well, and let's talk about the standing desks because, of course, most organizations don't want to buy people new desks. That costs money. What's in it for the company to buy me a standing desk?
Okay, one of the leaders in the standing, not sitting movement is a fellow, Professor Mark Hamilton, at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge. And I had him come to the university a few years ago because I knew him and I knew of the research he'd been doing. He said, come and give a seminar and so forth. And we're chatting as I think I picked him up from the airport. And I said, well, how much does a standing desk cost? And this was 4 or 5 years ago. He said, nothing. Nothing? And then I found out what he meant when I gave him a table in my office where he could work between meetings and so forth. He went out in the hallway and found one of the big boxes that they ship paper in, put that on the table, put his computer on top of that. He said, see, it didn't cost anything. And he recycled that box. So, I mean, you can do that. Or you can spend a few hundred dollars on one that you can raise and lower and go from sitting to standing in seconds. So, yeah, there are a lot of ways to do it.
What about treadmill desks?
That's fine. Those exist. I don't have one of those, although up in our lab, I did get a desk that goes over a treadmill, and anyone can go up and use that if they want to take a break, take their computer up and work on the walking desk. But there also are not only treadmill desks, but they're kind of cycle, you know, pedals that can go under your desk, so you could actually still sit, but you're pedaling on that while you're working on your computer. I've never tried one. I don't know of any real research on that point. But, again, there are lots of ways to become a little more active.
There's a minor trend of people sitting on exercise balls instead of desk chairs. Have you looked into that?
I don't know of any research on that topic. I mean, it does make sense. If you're sitting on the exercise ball, you are using some muscles that you don't have to use when you're sitting in a chair. So just from the general concept of using muscles is better than not using muscles, I suppose there could be benefits. I'm not aware of any research, actually.
Well, okay, we can have a freestanding desk, but still, not everybody's going to do that, and sometimes the workplace culture is formed from the top down. So what is it that's in it for a company to try to implement some of these changes?
20, 30 years ago, I did quite a lot of research on health promotion programs at the worksite, and the body of evidence from those kinds of studies continues to build. It just simply baffles me why America's companies, corporations, do not implement health promotion programs at the workplace, because essentially all the studies show a magnificent return on investment. Big. $3, $4, $5 return for each dollar invested in the program. Now, what's the return? Well, fewer medical bills, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of evidence supporting that. So why do companies seem to fight against implementing these health promotion programs? Now, it's not only exercise, of course. It's counseling programs for managing stress, stopping smoking, eating a healthful diet, all those kinds of things. But really, I am completely baffled. I think we are beginning to see a bit of a change in that. And I gave one lecture yesterday at the ACT company, and in the last couple of years, they're really getting a health promotion program for their employees up and running. And I think that's what companies need to do.
Now, some of your earlier work has focused on, again, back to the fact that we talk about this obesity epidemic all the time. A lot of your earlier work showed us that the correlation between being obese and not being fit is not as strong as most of us like to think it is. We talk a lot about the fact that there are a lot more fat people in the United States, and this is our evidence for a huge health crisis. But let's talk about that correlation. What are we missing?
Well, to maybe slightly correct you, there is a correlation between fitness and fatness. I mean, it's not a perfect correlation, but it does exist. The focus of our research has been on fitness versus fatness. In terms of predicting health outcomes, we've published dozens and dozens of papers on this. We have a huge cohort of 80,000 men and women we've been following. And I'll tell you, for virtually any health outcome, all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease mortality, heart attacks, strokes, et cetera, cancers, the people who are fat but are fit do not have increased risk. And in fact, the people who are normal weight but unfit over the next decade are twice as likely to die as those who are obese but fit. Fitness just essentially eliminates, I mean, if you take it into account, eliminates the health risk associated with obesity. And what really is just one of my passions, and again, I'm going to drop dead someday when another article comes out on obesity and health outcome X, and they don't even mention physical activity or fitness. That is junk science. That's like studying lung cancer and not even mentioning smoking. I mean, it's crazy. And every week in leading scientific journals, I find articles like that. I simply do not understand it. So
well, and it's not just scientific journals. I mean, if you pick up any magazine in the checkout line at the grocery store, you're going to find those articles too.
Oh, of course. Now, would I like to be tall, dark, skinny, handsome? Well, of course, that would be nice. Well, I'm not. I'm short, fat, and bald. But I am highly physically active, and so I think I'm getting a lot of health benefits from that. So physical activity doesn't make us all supermodels. It won't make many of us supermodels or professional athletes or whatever, but it can make you healthy and more functional, and that's why you should be doing it.
So what led you down this path of exploration? Was it a personal journey for you?
Well, I was an athlete in high school and college, a football player, and I thought I wanted to be a coach. So I went off to graduate school. I think I'll get my master's degree, and then I'll get a job as a coach in a small college like the one I went to. And then in graduate school, I said, oh, wait a minute, there's this stuff, science. And so I stayed and got my doctorate, and my career has been in that ever since. But I have continued with the interest in activity, exercise, health outcomes, benefits, and so forth. So I've always had the interest in activity and sports and so forth.
Those articles in all of those magazines in the checkout line at the grocery store, they sell us these ideas about what it means to be fit. And I have a couple of incredibly good friends who work so hard to be fit and are not thin. Have we just missed a huge concept in what fitness means?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You cannot tell by looking at someone. You can tell whether they're fat or not. Okay, you can see that. And we're essentially all biased against fat people. And all of the media stuff and the hype that goes along with it doesn't help that. So we have enormous bias against people who are overweight and obese. But you can't tell by looking at somebody. Oh, look at that fat guy. He's a heart attack waiting to happen. Well, and I like to ask doctors, okay, here's this fat guy whose blood pressure is 110 over 65, his cholesterol is 100, et cetera. What do you tell him to do? Well, I tell him to lose weight. Well, why? Well, now, if he wants to get a date to the prom, losing weight probably would be a good idea. Or, in fact, if he wants to get a job or get a promotion, because the bias and discrimination enters there. But I'm sorry, you cannot tell whether somebody is a good person by looking at them. I think you might be old enough. Do you remember Timothy McVeigh?
Yes.
Oklahoma City bomber?
Yes.
What did he look like?
Tall and skinny.
Tall and skinny. And, of course, you've heard of Osama bin Laden.
Also tall and skinny.
Look at the next news story you see about some terrorist. Look, they're all tall and skinny. They're out to get the fat people, you see. I'm stretching it
right,
a little bit.
Right. But the point is taken. You've also, in some of your writing, talked about research that shows that thin people who are not fit are just as high a risk of all of these health problems as people who are overweight and not fit.
Yes, that's true. And the obese person who is fit has a much lower risk of dying or some of these chronic diseases than the normal weight person who is not fit. I mean, fitness just trumps fatness. And you might wonder, well, what's he talking about, fitness? What does that mean? Well, in the big studies that we've done, it's from a maximal exercise test in a laboratory. It's not some estimate. It's how long does it take you to get to exhaustion on this treadmill. So it's a laboratory measure of your aerobic fitness. And it is a powerful predictor of morbidity and mortality.
I just think of all the heartbreak for all the people who are working so hard to lose weight and just aren't able to, because weight loss is not a simple calculation between the number of calories you take in and the number of calories you expend. I'll bet you've had some pretty amazing conversations with people who've been trying so hard for so long to be thin.
Well, I try, and it doesn't work. I'm 74, and for the last 4 years, I've taken 5 million steps each year. That's a lot of exercise. I'm pretty fit for a guy my age. I try to watch my diet. I eat, follow the guidelines and so forth, but I'm never going to be skinny. I just will accept that and get on with life, and that's what I recommend to people. Now, another issue that is not talked about very often is the prevention of the weight gain in the first place. I mean, once you become obese, we just don't have effective treatments that work for a high percentage of people. I mean, sure, we all know someone who lost 50 pounds and kept it off forever, but those are pretty rare. So diet is not going to do that. You can lose it in the short term, but it does. Most people don't keep it off. Exercise helps a little bit losing weight, but it's a lot easier to cut out 1,000 calories from your diet a day than it is to exercise 1,000 calories. So if you want to lose, you know, for your daughter's graduation or wedding or something like that, you want to lose 25 pounds, you better focus on really cutting back the calories, and you can do it. Now, can you keep it off? Most people can't. So do what you can do. Eat the healthy diet. Manage your stress, don't drink too much, don't smoke, and be physically active.
Do you find people who are afraid of the message that you're giving us right now, that don't want to move the conversation away from weight?
Oh, of course. Yeah, there's a huge group out there that is really focused on the obesity question, and I don't think it's going to go away. So I'm not terribly popular with some people by saying, well, forget about that. Let's just focus on the activity. But remember, I do keep saying, eat a healthful diet.
Right.
Be a good person. Go to work. Do a good job.
Don't blow up buildings.
Yes.
So there is so much emphasis in the media and in schools and in different anti-obesity campaigns on healthy diet. And healthy diet is very important. I mean, we just established that. But do you think that we are not giving kids, for example, the right message?
Well, no, I think we need to give them the message of eat a healthy diet, be physically active. Again, don't smoke. It's a healthy lifestyle. We need to do that, but we need to do a much better job than we currently do in America's education. A little over a year ago, our National Academy of Sciences, which is the premier scientific organization in this country, published a document, Science Education in the United States. It was a 600-700-page document. So I downloaded it. I went to the find box, and I typed in behavioral science. Shh, term not found. You mean there's no role at all for behavioral science in American education? I'm not opposed to physics and chemistry and math and so on. Of course not. But helping people learn about behavioral science and how to manage their own behavior, shouldn't that be a high priority in our educational system? And it isn't. You know, we have some physical education programs that are good, and we have a lot of them that are not good. We have some health education programs, but we can do a much better job with this. We need to bring the behavioral scientist into it. We need a K-12 curriculum on how to learn about it, behavioral science, and the key point would be how to manage your own behavior. Why don't we do this? Instead of just continuing to rant with all the magazines, you know, buy my book and follow my special diet or my special exercise program, and then you'll look like me, you know, that isn't working. Well, no, wait a minute. It's working very well for those people who are getting rich writing those books. It works very well for them.
I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Blair. He is an exercise scientist from the University of South Carolina and a Wellness Council of America expert on taking a stand on sitting down. We're talking this hour about his research into physical fitness and also his thoughts about what we need to be telling Americans. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest this hour is Dr. Stephen Blair. He is an exercise scientist from the University of South Carolina. He visited Iowa City last week to lecture on behalf of the Obesity Research and Education Initiative at the University of Iowa. And this hour, we're talking about physical fitness and our, quote, obesity epidemic in this country, which, as we've talked about, Dr. Blair, you believe is more of an epidemic of inactivity and our sedentary lifestyles. So let's talk solutions now. We've identified large parts of the problem. We've identified large parts of the problem with the messages that are getting sent to us in the public through the media and through scientific research as well. Okay, so what are the messages that we need to be sending?
Well, first of all, we do need to continue to focus on healthy lifestyles. Eat a healthful diet, don't swing, and so on, and certainly be physically active. It is not going to be easy, probably in any of these areas, but certainly for physical activity, since we've, as we talked about earlier, we've just engineered the need to move out of life, whether it's on the job, at home, transportation, and so forth. It's not going to be easy to get more people more active more of the time. Now, if everyone would go out for that walk or run or go to the gym, fine. I don't think that's going to happen. So what can we do to increase that? Well, for example, go to Copenhagen. And there you see a sidewalk where you can walk. Right next to it is a bicycle lane. And then next to that is the line of parked cars. And then the traffic. So the cyclists and the walkers are protected by that line of parked cars. So could we, now Iowa City is a pretty good place, actually. I mean, go to Atlanta or Chicago. You do have a walkable city. But in the big American cities, most of them are not very walkable or bikeable at all. And now there are some movements that are developing over the last few years to change that, and I think we need to take that very seriously. A few years ago, we released the first ever U.S. National Physical Activity Plan. How are we going to address this sedentary society? And we identified 8 different sectors in that plan. We had world authorities write papers on those areas. And then in each of the sectors, we developed strategies and tactics that should be put in place to try to help people be more active. Again, it is complicated. I can never remember all 8 of the sectors. factors at any one time, but you can imagine there are things like education and clinical medicine and public health and, again, transport and urban planning and so on. So it's going to be difficult because we've spent a couple of centuries. I go back and blame James Watt, invented the steam engine, and we started using that to do labor that people used to do. And we've just been engineering the need to move out of life. And we're not going to go back, as I said a moment ago, to the hunters and gatherer stage. But let's look for ways to make it easier and more enjoyable for more people to move more often. And then you do have the perfect right. We live in a democracy. You have the perfect right to be as sedentary as you want to be, to hardly ever stand up. Oh, that's your problem. Now, of course, it is a bit of my problem, too, because the health care costs go up and I do have to help pay for those. But we need to encourage people. Not everyone will do it. You know, you probably maybe wouldn't know what percentage of patients fill the prescription the doctor gives them and are still taking that drug 1 year later.
I don't know.
You know, it's probably 25-30%. So that's not perfect either. But I'm not saying we should stop prescriptions
right.
for statins and ACE inhibitors and so forth. So not everyone is going, and there are those stubborn people who are, the more I talk about it, the more they say, well, the more I'm going to sit, by golly, he's not going to convince me.
Well, there we've had a very high-profile campaign from the First Lady, from Michelle Obama, focusing on physical activity and diet for young people, her Let's Move campaign. You've been watching that. Do you think that that is an effective way to get that message out?
I don't think it's working very well. I'm an old 60s liberal. I was delighted when Mr. Obama was elected president to expose my political beliefs. I admire Mrs. Obama. She's obviously a woman of high achievement and high accomplishment. When she created the Let's Move, I thought, boy, that's great. Let's move. And when it was released, every interview that I heard or saw written about in the paper, there wasn't a word about physical activity. It was all about eating. So there isn't balance there. I mean, physical activity is a part of it, but it's like many other things we do. Oh, yes, that's good, but now let's get back to diet. For example, the National Institutes of Health, which is the primary research funding agency in this country. Billions of dollars a year go in. Well, of course, that's really going down, but nonetheless, you can go on the NIH website and find 233 categories of where their research money is spent on topics. You can find anorexia to flat feet, on and on. But if you look at obesity and nutrition, you find in the last fiscal year we spent about $2.2 billion. On those topics. So then I think, well, gosh, how much are they spending on physical activity, exercise, fitness? No, because it isn't even on the list. It's not even a category. Now, they do, I mean, I've had millions of dollars of support and from NIH, but they're not spending anywhere near $2.2 billion on physical activity. I'd like to see a little more balance. And I am not against, let's stop all nutrition research. But it's just another example of how it's always about nutrition. Well, not always. Okay, let's be fair. But it's nutrition and particularly fast foods, sugars, all those things. That's the cause of all the problems in the world. The evidence doesn't support that.
Have you seen there in the state of Iowa, we have the Live Healthy Iowa Initiative, which is it goes all year round and has different programs to try to incentivize people to work physical activity into their daily life. There are programs like this all over the place. There are corporations that are implementing wellness programs for their employees. What have you seen that works well that you would like to see implemented in other places?
Well, come back to behavioral science. We have to help people learn how to manage their behavior, whether it's balancing their checkbook or flossing their teeth or being physically active. And this is a line of research that has really started back in the 70s for how to get people to stop smoking. And then one of my colleagues, Professor Bess Marcus, who's now at the University of California, San Diego, brought those methods into the physical activity arena. And they've been used in the nutrition arena as well. But if you want to change your behavior, a good place to begin is, well, okay, how often do you floss your teeth? Your dentist wants you to do it every day. Yeah. Well, gosh, I don't know. I do it occasionally. Okay, let's get some data. Every time you floss your teeth, put a tally mark. And then let's see where you are. That's a starting point. And then, okay, let's set a goal. We find, I'm sorry to say, Charity, that your data show that you're only flossing your teeth once every 3 weeks. So, you know, I'm making this up, of course. Do you think you could get to once a week? Well, yeah, I could probably do. Okay, that's your goal then. So you got a goal. And so I talked to you next month, and they said, well, how are you doing on that goal? By golly, I made it. I flossed once a week, every week. Good for you. Remember, your dentist wants you to do it every day. Do you think you could increase that? Darn right, I'll go to two days a week. And so I see you then after that, and I say, how'd it go? Well, you know, some weeks I still only got one. So then here's another technique, problem solving. I say, well, Charity, what got in the way? You had the goal, you had good intentions, you wanted to do it. What interfered? And so we talk about that. And you say, well, maybe I could get around that by doing such and such. So it's things like that that we have to help people learn how to do, again, to manage any behavior.
But we can't all have a personal coach to help
that. No, of course not. But there are books you can buy, and a burgeoning area of work, and we've got a big new center at our university on this, is technological applications for lifestyle interventions. Just for example, you're a woman. I won't press you on this, whether you do it or not, but your doctor would like for you to do a breast self-exam on a monthly mm-hmm. basis. And I don't know whether you do or not. Doesn't matter. But there's an iPhone app that will send you a text message on whatever day is the correct day. Say, Chair, did you remember to do your breast self-exam? So that's very simple. It's not a big, expensive intervention, but we just need more and more things like that. And this is a really growing area of research. And we hope our new center will contribute to that. And there are folks here at the University of Iowa. Dr. Lucas Carr is very keen on doing that kind of work. So let's learn how to help people do it. Let's use modern technology. We can get there. It won't be 100%, but we can do better than we're doing.
There are a lot of apps already available to track your fitness, to track your activity levels. Have you used those?
Well, let me show you my accelerometer here. We brought these into our research back in the early 90s, and that's the self-monitoring. How active are you? Let's count your steps. And we've used that. So, yeah, that's something. There are a lot of apps. Now, there are lots and lots of apps and things that haven't been evaluated scientifically. I mean, the general concept, yes, the scientific evidence is strong. So now what do you expect a professor to say? Give me more money so we can do more research on all of these apps. And, of course, that is what our new center will do, is, you know, test apps that are out there, develop new apps, and so forth. My little 8-year-old grandson wants to be an engineer, and I think he's going to develop marvelous apps.
Now, you mentioned earlier that, of course, one of the big problems is we have to prevent obesity before it becomes a problem, because treating obesity is a monumental task.
It hasn't gone very well.
Right. So let's talk about kids, because of course kids are not born obese, and we do see increasing levels of obesity in kids, and also sedentary lifestyles have certainly spread down into our kids as well. What works with kids? What kinds of things can we do with kids, and what programs have you seen that you feel are effective?
Well, there are very good programs, physical education, health education in schools. Unfortunately, there are really not a lot of them, but there are programs that have been researched and find to work quite well. So obviously we need more of those. Now, prevention of obesity, I think, needs a lot more attention than it's been getting. And sure, let's start with kids, but prevention of obesity, you know, college, and as you start your life with a career and so forth, when people typically begin to gain weight. And I think the key to prevention is to get the energy expenditure up there. We're wired to eat and wired to sit. I mean, this actually, the hunters and gatherers, at every opportunity, they're going to sit down, lie down. So that's the kind of critter we are. So let's learn how to, and we need a lot more research on the prevention of obesity. But what we have at the moment, if you are physically active at a certain level, you're going to be much less likely to become obese in the first place. So let's continue to work on ways to treat and get the health benefits, but let's get some better programs on prevention. And I believe the good school programs on eating and physical activity are a good way to go. We just need a lot more of them. And then how do we continue that into life? Well, okay, universities can do that too. And I think here at the University of Iowa, they have similar programs. Well, then, yeah, but you're graduating, then what? Okay, the workplace. Let's come back to the workplace. Why can't companies provide these opportunities and these kind of programs to help people learn how to do this and manage their behavior? I'm an optimist. I believe we can do it. We just haven't had the commitment to do it.
I did an interview a little over a year ago with an expert who researches the psychology of how we eat. And one of the things that he talks a lot about is we need to create an environment where we eat less without having to think about eating less, using smaller dinner plates, that kind of thing. Some of what you're saying makes me think that you think we need to create an environment where we get more activity without thinking about it.
Yes, of course. Brian Wonsack and I are on the same page on these issues. He's done a lot of good research on this topic. I don't think that if we focus only on, you know, his approach and the eating and how we don't have to think, we just don't eat as much, that will be better than not using his approach at all. But it won't be really effective in preventing the obesity epidemic unless we also get people to get their energy expenditure up there. I am convinced, and this is, again, an area of current research, and we need a lot more research, it's just pretty much impossible for many people to stay in energy balance at a very low level of energy balance. And say 1,500 calories a day. It's just hard to stay in balance. Now, it's much easier to stay in energy balance at 6,000 calories a day. Oh my God, that means you're running a marathon every day. I don't think that'll work. But, and I don't know where the cut point is, and it's probably different for different people, and that's probably genetically determined. And there are a few people, like my Aunt Jean. She's a real Blair, tall and skinny, never exercised. I've never seen her turn down a piece of pie, all of that. But when she dies, she's going straight to hell because she's been living in paradise, you see. She's got the right genes that somehow she just matches her intake to her expenditure. Most of us aren't that fortunate.
Is there a particular area of research or device or idea right now that is most exciting to you?
Well, I think it's the use of technology. We do have all these devices to measure your activity, and from that we can get good estimates of energy expenditure. There is a company called Body Media, which is you wear it on your arm, and it gives you really good estimates or measures of your energy expenditure. They also have a website where you can enter what you ate yesterday. So it can calculate your energy balance. So if you want to not gain weight, if you want to lose weight, you can use that information. So I think using tech, and we did a research study using that approach, and it actually worked. So things like that, using modern technology, it's easier on the physical activity side. We've got a lot of good devices. We don't have devices for how do we measure what you put in your mouth. We
right.
have to measure every forkful, I guess. And so, I mean, it's a more difficult area to measure, but I think those approaches, they're coming, and we need to get them more widely disseminated.
Well, and right now in society, our measure, again, to return to the earlier point of a person's fitness, is our eyes. We look at somebody and we say, hey, they look good. Or we look at somebody and we say, oh, they don't look good. If I'm overweight and I'm trying really hard and I can't lose the weight, is there something that you can say, you know, shoot for this? This should be your definition of success.
Focus on healthy behaviors. Focus on being a good employee, on being a good partner, on being a good parent. Focus on doing the right thing.
Dr. Blair, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Dr. Stephen Blair is an exercise scientist at the University of South Carolina. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.